I was going to talk about the Four Noble Truths tonight. It's the beginning of a new season. I called the talk Rolling the Tummer Wheel. What are the Four Noble Truths? They are that there is suffering, that there is a cause of suffering, that there is a cessation of suffering, and there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. What do we mean by suffering? Well, the Buddha said, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, decay is suffering, death is suffering, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair are suffering. What he didn't say was losing your car keys is suffering. The milk going off in the fridge when you get home from work is suffering. Manifold sufferings that we all have to go through as a part of life. What then is the cause of suffering? The Buddha said the cause of suffering is always a passionate desire for life to be different than it is. Always preceding suffering, there will always be a passionate desire for life to be different than it is. The Buddha said that this comes from, it stems from, an ignorance of the way life really is. Were we free from that ignorance, if we saw life as it really was, there would be no attempt made to change life, because life is as it is, and therefore suffering could not arise. So what is the cessation of suffering? It is just that. It is nibbana, it's freedom from all the ills and travails of life. So what is the path to the cessation of suffering? It is the Noble Eightfold Path, which for this evening I'll just simply refer to in terms of the three trainings, the training in ethical discipline, sila, mental development, samadhi, and wisdom, panya. When the Buddha first began to give discourses, the very first discourse he gave was concerning the Four Noble Truths. It was called Setting in Motion the Wheel of the Dhamma. Why the Wheel of the Dhamma? I'd like to try and explain that if I can. He explained the Four Noble Truths in terms of three aspects and 12 modes. I don't want to baffle you with the science of it, it's actually fairly straightforward. The three aspects to each Noble Truth are these. There is a fact, there is a task to be undertaken, and there is the knowledge that the task has been completed. Now, in terms of the first Noble Truth, the fact is there is suffering. The task to be undertaken is that we have to fully understand suffering. And the knowledge is the knowledge that we have indeed fully understood suffering. The second Noble Truth, the fact is, there is a cause of suffering. The task is that we have to fully abandon the cause of suffering. And the knowledge is that the cause of suffering has been fully abandoned. The third Noble Truth, fact, there is the cessation of suffering. The cessation of suffering is to be fully realized. The knowledge is that the cessation of suffering has been fully realized. The fourth Noble Truth, fact, there is a path that can be undertaken. The task is to fully develop that path, and the knowledge is the knowledge that that path has been fully developed. Now, if you have three aspects to Four Noble Truths, my sums work out that's 12 modes, as the Buddha described it. And if you think of each mode as a spoke on a wheel, then you get the idea of why this is called the Wheel of the Dhamma. What this also demonstrates is that intellectual appreciation of the Four Noble Truths alone is never enough. You have to go beyond the fact. You have to undertake the task and gain the knowledge if you want to put an end to suffering. What's required is practical application. In order to demonstrate what I mean by all of this, I'd like to tell you an exciting story. In Thailand, at the beginning of the last century, there was a tradition for the monks to go on what's called tudong, which is walkabout in the jungle. Bunak was 9 when he ordained as a novice. He kept the 10 training precepts and practiced the 4 foundations of mindfulness and meditation. At 15, against his teacher's wishes, he felt the need that he had to test his practice. So he went into the jungles on tudong. Not long into his epic journey, he heard the sound of roaring tigers. The roar of a tiger apparently is truly frightening, and poor Bunak was truly frightened. But his pride wouldn't allow him to go back. He spent 9 days in the jungle experiencing the most terrible fear before he decided to put an end to it. I don't mean taking his own life, I mean putting an end to the fear. He decided it was better to be eaten by a tiger than face fear day in, day out. He reflected that in the midst of danger, he had placed himself deliberately. It was his kamma. He'd done it to test his practice. Wasn't it time to put the practice to the test? He pondered, where does misery come from? Where does fear start? How can it be eradicated? He came to the conclusion that he needed to get to the root of the problem. He decided to go and sit at a pond where he knew from trails around the area that tigers went to drink. He sat there in meditation. At dusk, he heard the roar of approaching tigers, and he was absolutely terrified. Goosebumps, hair on arms stood up straight, tight chest, stiff neck, tears, as you probably would expect in this situation. He reflected on the practice that he'd done so far. And remember, this guy's 15. He reflected on the sila, keeping the precepts, including the first one about not killing or harming animals. He also reflected on all that he'd done working on the 4 foundations of mindfulness and the meditation. He concluded that whatever happened, and he was fully expecting to die, he would gain a heavenly rebirth because of the work that he'd done. A few minutes later, there was a tiger just literally a couple of yards in front of him. And this is what Bunak did. He stood up, he went towards the tiger, he lowered his head, he lowered his body, and prostrated himself in front of the tiger. The tiger took a casual swipe at him and then jumped up onto higher ground and started to wander away. Bunak was, as you might expect, elated. The tiger didn't eat me. Danger did not come to me. At that moment, he lost his fear. He decided it was his kamma that he hadn't been eaten. He decided to follow the tiger. He followed it for about 20 meters. The tiger leapt at him. What did Bunak do? He casually walked towards the tiger. The tiger, seeing this, fled. Bunak had got rid of his fear of tigers. What is this to do with the wheel of tamma? He was certainly aware of the fact of suffering. And he was aware through the work that he had done that it was caused by craving. In this case, the craving was the fear that he was experiencing, the passionate desire for life to be different than it was. His prostration was, a symbol of him abandoning the craving that was the cause of the suffering. And in due course, he experienced the cessation of fear. Now, in order to do that, no one can just do that. You have to train in order to be able to do that. And in the court, as he demonstrated himself, he had developed the 3 trainings sufficiently to be able to abandon his craving in that marvellous way. Clearly, he had right view. There's karma, there's rebirth. The sila was there, the ethical conduct was there. He felt good about his behaviour. And, of course, there was mental development there. He was aware of the fear. He didn't react blindly to it. There was mindfulness present. So, in effect, what he'd done was send the wheel of tamma around full revolution, full rotation. He had the knowledge in that moment of the cessation of suffering. It wasn't enlightenment, but it was clearly the cessation of suffering, temporarily at least. It's a really, really, it's a great blessing that we don't have to go to the jungle to do this. But daily life can be something of a jungle for all of us, and we all experience our fair share of tigers. We do lose our car keys. We do suffer indifferent health. Relationships do break up. We do get cut up on the motorway. All sorts of events happen to us in the course of our everyday lives. Whatever we experience, though, in a sense, we've actually chosen. Just like Bunuk accepted the fact that he had chosen the circumstances he found himself in. The way we act has results. What we experience in the way of pleasant states and painful states is due to the actions that we perform. So we do really choose the situations that we come across. If we wish to spin the wheel of tamma, to roll the wheel of tamma in the same way, then we have to learn to accept the tigers in our life. We have to accept their presence. We have to accept the fact of suffering. But in accepting the existence of dukkha, it doesn't mean that we have to dance to its tune. We can change our responses. If we're open to the existence of suffering, then we can also be open to the existence of the cause of suffering, the resistance, the inability just to accept that life is as it is. We can't change our habits all at once, of course. It's a gradual training. It's a gentle building the muscles, the mental muscles, that's capable of looking directly at suffering. It helps enormously to create the necessary supports, daily practice, weekly attendance here, reading about the tamma, talking about the tamma, keeping the precepts, loving kindness, generosity, gratitude, the list goes on and on. But anything that we do in terms of creating the necessary supporting conditions will cushion life's blows for us. We'll have a good self-image. We'll be able to take the knock and bounce back a little bit easily, more easily. We'll have a certain self-respect, and there'll be fewer causes for worry. How does this work in practice? It's difficult to get the wheels set in motion in the first place. Is it possible, for instance, to be able to keep one precept just once? Forgetting all about becoming enlightened, but just being able to keep one precept just once. If we can, then we have successfully spun the wheel of tamma on that occasion. For instance, if letting somebody win an argument rather than getting into harsh speech, that's keeping a precept, that's restraining craving. Undoubtedly there'll be an unpleasant feeling arise because you're in a tense situation with someone who wants to have an argument. You may really believe that you're in the right and they're in the wrong. But there's a decision made to simply let the other person win the point. In order to do that, we had to restrain the tendency to passionately desire for life to be different than it was. We had to open up and allow life just to be as it was, just to let the other person win the point and for us to be left with an unpleasant feeling. Why did we do it? Because we didn't want there to be an escalation. We didn't want there to be tit-for-tat reprisals. We wanted peace. We wanted to experience the cessation of suffering. Now, right there, you have the wheel in its entirety. There's the understanding of suffering right there. There's the understanding of the cause of suffering right there. And, if you're successful, there's the experience of the cessation of suffering right there. The peace is kept. In order to do it, you had to keep the precept. Now, interestingly, that presupposes that there's already a certain amount of wisdom. There has to be right view. There has to be right intention already established to know that there's a precept to be kept. It also requires a certain amount of mindfulness to know what states of mind you're running and in order to enact the necessary restraint. So there must be sila, samadhi, and panya. So in this way you can see that all aspects of the Four Noble Truths, the three aspects, and the 12 modes are all present in one occasion of keeping the precept, just the once. Now with meditation, we have to go through exactly the same kinds of process. It comes as a shock for some people to realize that the purpose of meditation is to understand suffering. But that's the first noble truth, the fact of suffering, being able to fully understand suffering and to know that suffering has been fully understood. We want peace, tranquility, bliss, and wisdom from the meditation. And they certainly do arise, and they certainly do pass away. But the reality is, at times, there is anger, fear, depression, pain, rank escapism, restlessness, all aspects of a hindered mind. To try and explain how this wheel of tama works in this way, here's a story of a meditator who went to the teacher delighted. Why are you delighted, said the teacher? It's because for the first time, the meditator said, I'm doing nothing in the meditation. For so long, the meditator said, I was trying to fix the meditation. I was trying to make it peaceful, to make it tranquil, to make it calm, to make it blissful, to engineer wisdom. And for the first time, after many years, I've just given up. I let whatever happened, happen. Whatever wanted to happen, I just stopped completely. Almost stopped meditating completely, but I was sat in the chair. And to my complete astonishment, the mind went quiet. It was as if everyone in town had suddenly just dropped tools and decided to sit in deck chairs. It was so quiet, it was so peaceful, it was so delightful. So what's this person done then? Well, they've understood suffering. They've understood suffering and they abandoned the passionate desire to make life different, to make the mind different in that moment. It's exactly the same in its own way that Panak did in prostrating before the tiger, accepting the fact of suffering, accepting that it was there. The result, through that non-interference, was that the mind just gently quietened down all of its own accord. Now the meditator thought that they were doing nothing, but that wasn't actually true. They had mentally developed themselves sufficiently through this, all those years and all that practice, that they could actually sit there doing nothing, apparently doing nothing. But right there was right view, there was panya, there was samadhi, mental development. Just in that moment, the wheel of tamma was spun and the cessation of dukkha was experienced right there in that moment. So the key is to develop the skill in restraining from trying to fix the meditation and just let it settle down of its own accord. Now, in understanding suffering in this way and learning how to restrain the mind, restrain the craving, restrain that passionate desire, and experiencing the cessation of suffering, like the meditator did in that example, it's not quite complete liberation from suffering. The Buddha described it as painful habitual restraint. You have to actually do something specific in order to create that cessation of suffering, to create that lovely space, to create that peace and that calm. If you don't do that restraint, you don't get the peace and the calm. So to that extent, you're still a slave. There's not the complete freedom, there is not the full realization of the cessation of suffering that the Buddha's intending that we find. To find it, we have to return to the fact of suffering once more. But now we have to look at the suffering at a far more deeper level. In fact, the deepest level of all. Having successfully restrained the mind in order to create this lovely, peaceful state, we have to put it to use. Anyone who finds that lovely, calm, peaceful, tranquil space in their meditation will find that with just a very, very tiny little effort, you will witness, for perhaps the first time, that everything in your experience is arising and passing away. So now we're getting into insight, looking at mind and body in great detail to try and look closely and find out the reality behind appearances. Specifically, I'm thinking of in this talk is understanding suffering, the fact of suffering in conditioned and conditioning phenomena. The more we look, the more we see that nothing lasts. Everything is just so fleeting. You hear a car going down the road, you have a perception of the wheels on the tarmac, you hear the sound, and it just becomes, the more you look, it just becomes so insubstantial, ephemeral. It's just there and it's gone within a second, within a nanosecond. The more you look in this way, the more you see that everything in our experience, whatever we turn our attention to, has this same ephemeral quality. What comes out of this insight is that there's nothing we can depend on, there's nothing we can grasp hold of, there's nothing that we can actually rely on in any of it. The more deeply we look into this moment, or whatever we find, the more we start to undo the wrong views, the wrong ideas, the wrong perceptions that we have that make us think that we can go around fixing life to meet our requirements, which essentially is what craving is. The more you see the insubstantial nature of life, the more you realise that there is nothing that you can depend on, the more you let go of the idea that there is anything that you can depend on. The more you replace that wrong view with a right view, that there is nothing that you can depend on. Now, although that might sound as though that's exacerbating the problem, it does precisely the reverse, because you just simply stop craving. Not all at once, but it's a gradual process. Gradually, as time goes on, you just find that you can't. You cannot believe that it could be different than it is in that moment. Now, if you take that back to daily living and daily life, when you lose your car keys, you lose your car keys. You still go around looking for them, but the belief that it should have been different goes away. So you get home and the milk's off. All right, we'll have a black one then. Why do you need a white coffee or a white tea? You still experience the tigers, but you don't suffer from it because you don't expect it to be any different. For instance, while back now, I saw Alan at a computer that was a bit wonky, and we were trying to fix it. And it was a great lesson for me, because suddenly everything just turned off. We were working on something, we were nearly there, and then everything just turned off. And Alan just went, "Pah." Well, what else are you supposed to do? If there's no thought that it should be different than that, then problem solved. Now, if we keep on spinning the wheel, if we keep on, no matter where you are in all of this, if you keep on spinning the wheel, then you'll reach the point of that where you just let go, because how could it be different in that moment? When it comes to enlightenment, there is a one moment where you see the whole issue in just the most exquisite clarity, and you can never be fooled again. At that point, suffering is fully understood. At that point, craving is fully abandoned. At that point, nibbana is fully realized, and the path is fully developed. And there's absolutely no equivocation about that. Interestingly, there's also a realization that there's nothing more to do. There's nothing more to understand. There's nothing more to abandon. There's nothing more to realize. There's nothing more to develop. And you realize in that moment that you've transcended the wheel. You've transcended the Four Noble Truths. You've transcended the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha himself said, "Only when the absolute, true, intuitive knowledge regarding these Four Noble Truths under their three aspects and 12 modes became perfectly clear to me, then only did I acknowledge that I had gained the incomparable supreme enlightenment." Oh, I've got time. I'll finish with another story. This is a story that the Buddha told to his monks to make a point. A king requests two new wheels for his chariot from a wheelwright. The wheelwright takes 6 months less 6 days to make one wheel. The king goes to see him to find out how the wheels are coming along, because in 6 days he's going into battle and he'll need his wheels. The king sees that there's only one wheel that's been made. The wheelwright assures him that he can make the other wheel in the 6 days. So 6 days later, the king goes back, and the wheelwright hands both wheels to him. The king looks at them, and you can see no difference between them. The wheelwright takes them from him and says, "I'll explain this to you." And he sets rolling the wheel that took 6 days to make. It goes a little distance, and then it wobbles, and then it circles around, and then it falls to the ground. Then the wheelwright takes the other wheel, the one that took 6 months less 6 days to make. He rolls it, it rolls, and then it stops, and it stands still, firm. It doesn't wobble, it doesn't circle, it doesn't fall to the ground. The wheelwright explained, "Well, with the 6 day wheel, it was crooked. It was faulty. It was flawed in its rim, in its spokes, and in its hub. But the one that took 6 months to build, it wasn't crooked. It was faultless. It was flawless in its rim, in its spokes, and in its hub." So what do we learn from this little story? Is your wheel yet free from crookedness? Is it entirely faultless? Is it entirely flawless? Because if you want that wheel to do the job for you, it will need to be. But every time you spin a little wheel, it's wheels within wheels within wheels. You help to spin a larger wheel, which in turn spins a larger wheel. Just a little bit, just a little bit, just a little bit. In fact, it's all we can do is just keep on spinning the wheel in whatever way that we see, in whatever way that we can. Eventually, we will perfect that wheel. We will perfect the spinning of it. We will roll it, and then it will just stand firm, and the job will be done. Thank you very much.